Hello once again, and welcome back to Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon to discuss urology is Dr. Paul Pietro of Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley. Dr. Pietro earned his Doctor of Medicine degree from the University of Virginia School of Medicine and was a resident in both general surgery and in urologic surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. He specializes in general urology, including the treatment of kidney stones, surgical kidney cancer management, BPH, and PSA screening. Dr. Pietro, welcome to the Vox Pop. I should tell people that when they call, it's a most unusual situation. They can speak to you either in English or in Latin, which you taught for many years before you became a doctor of medicine.
Yeah, that'd be a little difficult at this point.
Would it be?
It would be. 20 years is a long time.
Wow. Anyway, it's like a horse, though, isn't it? Sort of you never forget.
I can still conjugate the verbs.
Oh, boy. To be part of today's conversation, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you've got a urological question, you're going to want to ask it fast because every one of these phones is going to light up. And I know it because it's a very distinguished guest and I just know it. Okay, so Dr. Pietro, let me ask you this question. Right now, there are those of us who, I'm getting a little older and we get a PSA test every year. And how accurate are those PSA tests?
Well, actually, not very.
Uh-oh.
No, not accurate. Helpful, but not accurate.
Why helpful and not accurate?
Well, it's just not very specific for prostate cancer exactly. It's specific for the prostate gland making more of that normal protein. So a regular, benign, enlarged prostate, which happens as we age, that goes up. So just the regular prostate, as it gets bigger, will make more PSA. Any kind of inflammation will make a little more PSA. And, of course, prostate cancer can make PSA.
Right.
So it's not specific for just that problem.
But wait, what if you continually have a very low PSA?
Yeah.
Can that be a false sign also?
It can, although a very low PSA, particularly at a baseline, you might check in your 40s. If you start off with a nice low PSA, you actually can feel fairly comfortable that your eventual risk of prostate cancer puts you in a low category. You know, I learned a while ago to avoid the terms always and never, because, there's always an exception. But a low baseline PSA, consistently low, puts you in the low risk pool.
Now, if somebody comes in with a high PSA, and let's say they're in their 40s or 50s even,
right.
You are likely to do the next step. What's that?
So first you want to find out, is this the only PSA they had drawn? It could be a false positive. You might check again several weeks later, and it comes back down, and everyone feels more relieved. But typically we'll ask some history. Is there anything that could have given us a false rise? You might check again. And of course, you'll do a physical exam and want to feel the surface of the prostate. Is there any nodularities, any lumps or bumps on it that might make us more suspicious?
But don't you do biopsies?
You might get to that, which would be the more definitive and potentially the next step, which we could do with really better tolerance than years ago. Most people will do some type of a lidocaine block. You go to the dentist, they numb up your gums, they inject some lidocaine, and voila. Well, we can do the same thing around the prostate, really, to take away a lot of that sting. Getting the lidocaine there is not so much fun, but once it's there, we can really move ahead.
And then you take SNPs, right?
Yeah, needle-guided. It's a needle that spring-loaded device kind of springs out, grabs a little sliver, slides back, and typically we'll do 12 is a pretty standard pattern.
Right, and I've had it, so I know there's a sort of an ouch, factor to it.
Sure.
But you can still miss a cancer node by doing that, can't you?
You can. We think that most biopsies will pick up cancer about 90% of the time if it's there. So that's a 90% sensitivity. So the false negative of that should be fairly low, more in the 10% range.
So I guess the next issue would be, what if you're 70 years old and your PSA goes up?
Well, prostate cancer in general is fairly slow. So for the majority, it doesn't cause someone's death. It doesn't kill them right away. It might take years, 5 years, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. So take a look at somebody's age and take a look at somebody's health. There's some really healthy 70-year-olds and there's some really unhealthy 65-year-olds. So it's not just age as an absolute value. It's their life expectancy. And, you know, we're not great at predicting how much longer someone's going to live, but we have some good estimates. This gentleman looks pretty healthy. He's probably got at least 10, 15 years ahead of him. That's the guy you might go ahead and consider doing a biopsy.
So if you find cancer in a man, do you then, because I've heard of this term watchful waiting. Is that right? I mean, what is that?
Yeah, we've played some semantics, and I think we're really calling that more active surveillance at this point. Watchful waiting would imply you wouldn't do anything until something bad happened. It goes to the bones. They have some pain. There's some there's some complication of that. Surveillance really implies that we're really watching that prostate cancer. And many times we may never intervene with that prostate cancer. But the surveillance means you're trying to catch it and consider converting to active treatment before before it spreads, before it gets out of hand.
Another subject, HPV, human papillomavirus. This is something you look for, do you not? Because we think that in women this causes cervical cancer.
So interesting enough, cervical cancer may actually be an acquired disease or an STD even of sorts.
Right.
So you avoid the colonization with that virus and you can really prevent later problems.
Now, we're giving injections, right, to women, vaccinations, to prevent the HPV. Should we be giving them to men, too?
So there is some move, whether we should be vaccinating. And that is, you need to vaccinate before you have the disease.
So if a woman has the disease and is vaccinated, what happens to her?
Yeah, well, nothing, because you already have the disease. So you need to get the vaccine before you get exposed to the virus, which is why, you know, the pediatricians and maybe even the GYNs, when they're seeing the young adolescent girls, they're really recommending a vaccination before they become sexually active. And the same thing would be with boys. And there's some push and some thoughts that maybe young males should be vaccinated before they become sexually active.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. So in urology today, what's hot?
Well, prostate cancer is always a topic of great concern. I mean, it is the number one cancer, other than skin cancers, in men. Kidney stone prevention, not so hot, but important. There's a lot of talk about how to treat women appropriately for incontinence. Did I mention prostate cancer is always hot? That's always a popular topic. Yeah. But there's some real great moves that have happened in the last few years, too, in terms of medications for advanced disease, things we really didn't have just a couple of years ago.
Like?
New medications called abiraterone works, really shuts down the production of testosterone. There is the new...
Now, why is that good, to shut down the testosterone?
The only urologist to get the Nobel Prize did it for their work treating prostate cancer with estrogen. Hudgens and Hodges, I think it was like 1951 or 2.
Did you say Hudgens and Hodges?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it's a great name.
There were two guys, and they really looked at and discovered that prostate cancer is hormonally sensitive. So if you starve prostate cancer of testosterone, you can't cure it, but you can slow it down.
Interesting.
And so there are some that spawned a whole bunch of treatments then later on, Lupron shots and other depot injections. And now there's sort of the next generation of that thought is how really just to shut down that entire axis from adrenal glands out to the testicles and really how much the steroids can be made.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's the whole Provenge, Sepolizol T. That was a real hot topic. First really immune therapy for advanced cancer that has some benefit. Very expensive too, which is part of the controversy.
Right. How much of the stuff that is now considered to be, helpful, how much of that is experimental to the point where it's available to some who can afford it, but not to everybody?
Medicare approves some of these medications.
Right.
The Provenge actually did get Medicare it got voted to be approved. And that's $90,000 roughly for a year's treatment.
Yeah.
So the experimental things, you know, that the insurance companies and the government doesn't always buy onto all those, as you know. There are always trials. So a nice way to get into something where it's experimental and it's being studied is to be involved with clinical trials. I'm sure they're doing clinical trials. I know they do clinical trials up here at Albany Medical Center.
Yeah.
And we actually, our own group has 9 docs, and we have a whole research department. And we are involved with usually phase 3, sometimes phase 2 trials. So, you know, even sometimes a larger group can also help facilitate some of these new medications as they come out.
Well, we've got 2 people on the phone, but I wanted to ask you this. When I go into a urologist's office, sometimes I see women. I think men make the stereotypical assumption that because of prostate and other things, urology is a man's specialty. That's not right, is it?
And are you talking about as the patients or as the providers?
The patients.
Well, certainly guys make up a lot of our patients, of course. They have troubles urinating, they have BPH, they have prostate cancer, but kidney stones are not particularly gender specific. We treat a lot of infections. We treat a lot of bladder dysfunction, and that's really not not related to just the men. So a third, two-fifths of our patients are women.
Well, we're going to come right back. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to talk to Roger and Claire. So you guys stay right where you are.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care, wound healing, and hyperbaric medicine, sfhospital.org. Berkshire Classic Leather and Silver, Lenox, Massachusetts, featuring travelwear luggage by Briggs & Riley, silver jewelry, leather jackets and coats and accessories by Brighton, 413-637-0727. The New Netherland Institute, presenting the history of the Dutch colony, helping to secure the future of the New Netherland Research Center, the New York State Library in Albany, newnetherlandinstitute.org for memberships and information. And The Saratogian, sponsoring the Taste of Home Cooking School with recipes, cooking tips, entertainment, and more, Monday, May 14th at the Saratoga Springs City Center, saratogian.com for tickets and information.
All right, off to Roger. Roger, you're on the phone. Hello, Roger. You there?
I'm here.
Great. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a question on behalf of my wife who's driving the car, so I'm going to ask my question and turn up the radio. Basically, my wife is 56. She's had diabetes for 46 years. She's type 1. She has the early signs of kidney disease and is trying to figure out whether or not taking calcium supplements is appropriate for her.
Okay, stay right there for a moment, Roger. Go ahead, Doc.
So, well, you know, first off, 40 years is a long time to be managing her diabetes. So apparently she's been doing a good job, because that's a long time to manage type 1.
Yeah, she's type 1 for 46 years, yes.
Yeah, well, good job then for her surveillance, you know, and her vigilance. So calcium supplements, from a urology standpoint, there's really one major focus from the urologic thoughts, and that's really how it relates to potential kidney stones. You know, so kidney disease usually speaks to how diabetes or hypertension or other diseases affect how well the kidney can filter your blood and get rid of the waste products. And unfortunately, I'm going to do a little bit of a punt on that. That's generally the role of the nephrologist to talk about that. And that's a medical kidney doctor. We tend to be the surgical kidney doctors. But in terms of kidney stones, that's a funny question right now, because as you know, vitamin D and calcium is widely popular in American medicine, and it is important that we maintain these supplements. You do need some basic levels. And you know, for example, if your wife has had a bone scan and shown that her bones are thinner, then she has some osteopenia or early bone thinning, then it is really important that she supplement those to protect her bones. But you know, in America, it's sometimes if the sum is good, more is better. And it's not always important that people double up or triple up the calcium that they need. I think we're seeing, I don't have any great data, but I think we're seeing some increased kidney stones even amongst women, partly because of a little over-enthusiasm with calcium supplementation. I mean, you do need to replace it. You do need to keep your basics. But going overboard is not always the best. But in terms of kidney disease, probably a good question for her diabetic doctor or even her nephrologist.
Roger, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Okay.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and off to Claire in Lakeville. Claire, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the discussion about vaccinations to HPV.
Yes.
I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old daughter, and when her pediatrician started talking to me about it, when she was probably about 10, I was really reluctant because I didn't, frankly, want her to be a guinea pig for a new vaccination.
Yeah.
So, but I recently kind of changed my thinking, and she has received three injection series.
Yes, right, and that is often done in the pediatrician's office because they're seeing these ladies at that age. Sure.
Right. So she has had the first two, and she'll have the third in June. And her brother, who is 17, has also had the first two. So I decided to go that route.
Yes.
So I know, at least in this region, in northwestern Connecticut, it's something that physicians are discussing with the parents of their patients.
No, I think that's great. And, certainly I made it this far through training and practice. So clearly I buy into the whole Western medicine view of prevention and even treatments. And, we've made some great strides with vaccinations. You think about the people died, at age 30, 40, 100 years ago.
Exactly.
And a lot of that has really been prevented by vaccines, mumps, measles,
right,
all these things. So why not the next one?
Right. And it was actually, I'm just remembering now that it was a woman pediatrician, I believe, that I heard on NPR. It was probably WAMC because I don't travel much. But it was something she said that convinced me it was the right way to go. And it was that she said, years ago, we used to talk about someday there will be a vaccine against cancer. And this actually is a step very close to that direction. It doesn't guarantee that a woman will not contract cervical cancer in her future, but it's something to reduce her risk.
Absolutely. And, the human papillomavirus is actually multiple subtypes. It's probably, I should know the answer to this question, but I'm sure there's at least 100 different subtypes of HPV.
Right.
And the vaccine, there's two different brands, but they really only target several of those subtypes.
Right.
18,
that's,
16,
that's a very
31.
Good point.
And so, but those are the ones that are most closely associated and linked with cervical cancer.
Right.
So, they've done a great job, and I think it's great that we really can vaccine against a cancer.
Yeah, but she was a very eloquent speaker, and I wish I could remember the program, and that's what compelled me to go ahead and do it, because that was just such a solid argument.
Fantastic.
Anyway.
It's a good story. It's a good
story
about WMC.
Story. Yeah.
Thank
it is. It's a good station. So
thank you, Claire.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
All right. Take good care. Bye now.
Yeah. Karen in Pittsfield. Karen, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling on behalf of my father. He's 86 years old. A couple of years ago, he was treated for prostate cancer. It was an aggressive form, and he actually is very healthy. They treated him with hormones and also the top-of-the-line radiation therapy.
Yes.
His PSA now is zero. Everything's good with the prostate cancer.
Good.
But he is suffering now with chronic radiation proctitis.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's becoming, a quality of life issue. Basically, just a lot of bleeding every few days.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you have any knowledge of, how that kind of thing is treated.
Yes. So radiation is useful. It's one of the two main ways, of course, to cure and treat prostate cancer. Surgery is one and radiation is the other. And radiation, unfortunately, has what I call the innocent bystander effects. It's not so much what it does to the prostate, hopefully treating the cancer, but it's the bladder and the rectum and the nerves that go out to the penis that can be affected by that energy. The energy just spills. It's hard to localize it exactly. So what your dad has is the injury to the other side of that wall. So on the far side of the prostate is the rectum. The management of that oftentimes can be done really with a gastroenterologist. Sometimes us urologists are involved, and we'll start patients off. It often does involve like Proctifoam or one of those steroid type foams or creams that you might find as treatment for hemorrhoids, say.
He did try that, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I've heard of something called argon gas ablation.
Right, and so then these, if you were to look at the wall, there's going to be some significant red patches, telangiectasia, the blood vessels that are really abnormal, and that's what's breaking down and bleeding. And a good GI doc might have access to either cauterizing those areas, or you can essentially, well, you kind of burn those areas. And one tool is an argon beam coagulator, and that's what you're referring to. And that's just one way of delivering a heat energy that will scar those blood vessels down and make them try to stop. There are a few other treatments too. We do sometimes see bleeding from the bladder from radiation as a result of the radiation. And there can be some results from hyperbaric oxygen. Now, where's your dad live? Where are you guys calling from?
He's in northern New Jersey.
Yeah, I'd have to think that there's some hyperbaric centers for there for sure. And it's basically a diving bell, right? So you get placed inside this cylinder, and it's plexiglass, so people don't get claustrophobic. They can see out. They lock you in, and they close the chamber, and they increase the pressure inside, like you would some coming out of diving having the bends, yeah. And that forces oxygen into the tissues, and that's a way to treat sometimes radiation-induced injuries. So if he hasn't thought about that, I would definitely search out a local wound care center or hyperbaric center, and some of your physicians should know that those references and those places.
Okay, so it's something that he is going to try to see his gastroenterologist, and it is something that they would be very familiar with?
They should be, yes. They should know about the argon beam or the ABC coagulator, and hyperbaric should be something on their radar. There are times if it's really severe, it might even require, essentially a bowel diversion to deflect the fecal stream so it doesn't go past the rectum and bother it. But that's really much farther down the line.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Dan, thanks for the great
very
call.
Good.
Very interesting, and thank you, Doctor. I was fascinated.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bill in Hyde Park. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my wife is going to have an ultrasound next week, and because of the constant blood being in the urine. Now, the doctor ruled out there's no infection involved, but we're concerned, what if that is the case? There is blood, and would it necessarily be cancer or of the bladder?
So blood in the urine, how long has that been going on?
I'd say it's been going on for about a year or so, a year or two.
Ooh, okay. Okay, definitely from the urine and not from...
I think we go to your group. We have the best group in the Hudson Valley. We go to, and the best doctor. So
well, Hyde Park is right next door. I live and practice in Rhinebeck as well, so welcome to the neighborhood.
What we're doing is she's getting up every half hour, hour on the hour at night, and then she just had knee replacement surgery, so it's driving her nuts.
Sure.
But she's on some kind of a medicine to help relieve pressure in the bladder, but we're wondering what happens if, God forbid, if you did have... It did show cancer. What do they do? Radiation, or do they remove the bladder, or what? Or it depends on
right.
the
well,
gravity.
I hate to be so quick to say it depends, but I can give you kind of a rundown of the basics of this. So, blood in the urine, particularly visible blood, we almost always perform an evaluation and figure out where that's coming from. And
it's not visible, but it's just through the blood testing.
Okay, so microscopic blood in the urine
right.
as well. Right.
And right.
I tell you, we evaluate a lot of that too. So microscopic blood in the urine, gross blood in the urine, there's a fairly straightforward initial set of evaluations. Most people will have some type of imaging test. And if you're really worried and there's some risk factors, smoking, age, previous radiation exposure, you really might be getting a CAT scan because that gives us the greatest amount of information up and down the urinary tract, the kidneys all the way on out to where people void. Typically, we'll do some urine tests looking for microscopic cells, malignant cells in the urine. There's a couple of different tests there. And then most people will end up with a bladder telescope or a cystoscopy. People still get colonoscopies because that's the best way to look for polyps and things in the colon. No test has fully replaced looking inside the colon. In the same way, no test has replaced looking inside the bladder. So we almost always will do a bladder telescope. And then just to jump really ahead of what you're
watching. She's having an ultrasound. I mean, that's preliminary. I guess that's a preliminary test.
Yeah, and that's helpful, but that's really not going to answer all the questions. There'll still need to be, a more complete evaluation.
Okay.
In bladder cancer, to to completely oversimplify, bladder cancer comes in sort of two flavors. Less aggressive, superficial, it's a nuisance, but highly managed, and you can just keep ahead of that. And then, again, the other oversimplification is a more aggressive, and that really oftentimes is treated with a more major surgery for aggressive bladder cancer. And, of course, I have no idea if your wife has aggressive bladder cancer.
And what is the major surgery?
You take out the bladder.
And what replaces it?
Well, there's a couple of different techniques. Essentially, you have to divert the urine out through another path. And so you can take a piece of intestine and either bring it up to the skin, someone wears a bag or an appliance, or you can take a longer piece of intestine, kind of open it up, reconfigure it to make a pouch, and people can void through the urethra or they can catheterize into it. So you can either create an internal bladder pouch or you can even bring it out to the skin and have it divert that way. Luckily, only about 30% of bladder cancer is really the more aggressive. And if someone has bladder cancer, two-thirds or so is generally the more superficial and easily managed with maintenance and surveillance and things. Your wife would need to complete that evaluation, but there's a good chance she may get more complete imaging than the ultrasound. She'll get some urine tests, and I can fairly guarantee that she'll get a bladder telescope.
Okay.
And one last thing, the bladder telescope, how does that work?
Generally, it's a flexible fiber optic telescope that travels through the urethra back into the bladder.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, doctor. Thank you, Al.
Yep. Let's go to Sharon in Ballston Spa, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are real good. Go ahead, Sharon.
Hello, doctor. My husband had a radical prostatectomy about 13 years ago.
Yes.
And for the last several years, his PSA numbers have been rising.
Okay.
What are some of the reasons for the rise of PSA now?
Okay, before you go on, Doc, can you explain to us what the radical prostatectomy is?
Sure.
They get rid of the prostate, or what happens?
Right, so a radical prostatectomy means that you're removing the entire prostate gland.
Uh-huh.
And there's a gap now between the bladder and the urethra, so the bladder will get sewn to the urethra. So men should still be able to urinate through the urethra normally.
Okay.
There really should be no PSA when the prostate is out.
Interesting.
So the prostate should be the sole source of PSA. To answer your question and then also to generalize, PSA rising, it really is going to depend on how fast and how much. And some of it also will depend on what his initial pathology was. Do you by any chance remember what his Gleason score was when he had his prostate surgery removed?
I don't have that handy, no.
Yeah, and that was 13 years ago.
Yes.
And so the Gleason score, Alan, because you'll ask, is what does that mean? Well, for every kind of cancer, you want to know where it is, where it isn't, how far has it gotten. That's the staging. And then for every kind of cancer, whether it's breast, prostate, kidney, whatever, what's the grade? And the grade tells us how aggressive it is. There was a pathologist named Gleason who died a couple years ago, and he developed a way to rank how aggressive the prostate cancer looked. So for longer, I'll shorten it, but Gleason basically runs from 6 to 10 now. 6 is the least aggressive and 10 is the most. So if your husband had a Gleason 6 cancer, already we're a little less concerned because that was not the most aggressive cancer to begin with. The fact that it was 13 years ago is actually really good. There was a very nice article several years ago, came out of Duke. I'm sorry. Ooh, they'd hate me to hear that. It came out of Hopkins.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. That would,
now you've done it.
It got ruffled a few feathers. But a guy named Pat Walsh is a very famous urologist there. Large survey of patients. So they mined his data, look at all the patients and the data from there. So the time that you might have had your surgery and the time that it takes for it to recur, the longer, the less worry.
But back to your original point, Doc. If you're not supposed to have any PSA,
right,
because the thing is gone,
right.
Then where is the PSA that Sharon's talking about coming from?
Right. So this would imply that there is some prostate cancer someplace in his body. And it might be a little bit left over. There might have been right near the margins of where they removed the prostate, the edges of that. Maybe there's a little tiny nest or focus of it that had made out to a lymph node that people hadn't recognized. So unfortunately, that does imply that there is some prostate cancer someplace.
There's no other reason that it does have to be cancer.
But if the PSA is 0.1 and hasn't changed for 5 years, then it may just be a little bit of benign tissue got left behind. So we'll give ourselves, the urologist will give themselves a slight hedge. So if your PSA doesn't go up higher than 0.2 after your prostate's been removed, we're not worried.
Okay.
So if it's made it up to 0.1 and hasn't budged, it may be a little benign gland left. Mm-hmm. So the
0.07?
0.07, which is, so we're talking hundredths, not even tenths.
Well, that's correct.
Yeah. Not too much to worry about. So generally slower, later, and a very slow rate of rise would imply that there might be some prostate cancer, but unlikely to threaten his life expectancy. So the people who had a late, slow rise basically died of prostate cancer 0% of the time in this large series. Now, how old is your husband now?
69.
So he was 56 when he had his surgery, which was years ago.
Yeah.
So all in all, it's hard to say, and I hate to be a little vague and give ourselves some wiggle room, but the likelihood that a 0.07 is going to threaten his life is really low. I mean, he really should worry about his cholesterol. How's his heart doing? It's much more likely.
Right.
450,000 men die a year of heart disease, and 35,000 die of prostate cancer. So we care about prostate cancer, but let's not forget the priorities.
Sharon,
I'm very glad I called.
Yeah,
thank
it was a
you.
Very good call, Sharon. Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, we're going to take a very short break, and we will be right back for the end of the program.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Program in Social Work and Graduate and Undergraduate School of Nursing at St. Francis Hospital in Poughkeepsie. Hosting an open house Tuesday, May 1st from 6 to 8 p.m., adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years' experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Boyden and Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, offering lawn and garden equipment sales, parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, boydenandperron.com. And Electric City Chorus, a men's a cappella singing in the barbershop style, with concerts and events throughout the year, rehearsals Tuesday evenings in Schenectady, 518-391-9423. Support for Vox Pop comes from...
And we are back with Dr. Paul Pietro of Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley. You got a telephone number?
845-437-5000.
Okay. So on the line with us is Jim from Stone Ridge. The number here is 1-800-348-2551. Jim from Stone Ridge, go ahead.
Yes, my question goes back to the beginning of your program, PSA screening, to screen or not.
Yeah.
One reads regularly of aggressive treatment of the things found in the screening, which often, or at least frequently, often enough, produces very unpleasant side effects. And just to put an edge on it, I'm 71 and in good health. Would you think I should be doing regular screening? And is there, if I continue in good health, is there an age where you'd say, well, don't bother anymore?
Yeah, well, if we've got a couple hours, we could talk about this topic. But, I'll reference back to a couple of things we mentioned before. Is there should not be, I think, a set line of the sand on age. But you really should look at the age and potential, well, not the age, I'm sorry, you should look at the life expectancy, the health. How many more years you potentially had to have ahead of you? So if you're really healthy, 72-year-old, you really might consider prostate cancer screening. Now, just a quick little foundation. So to answer this question, you have to understand some of the basics of prostate cancer. So again, it's the number one solid organ cancer in men. It used to kill 45,000 men a year. It's down to about 30. Or put another way, it used to be 38 per 100,000 men in the early 90s. And now it's 22 per 100,000 men in the 2010.
And why is that?
Because of PSA screening.
Well, but now there are people in your community. Yeah.
Sure.
Ahead.
So the other side. So we have made a difference. One of six guys showed up with advanced, really bad prostate cancer. Now it's 1 in 50. So we have truly made benefits in morbidity and mortality, right? Sickness and death, which is great. However, if you did an autopsy study, there's been, you know, numbers predicted about 90% of all 90-year-olds would have cancer in their prostate. So if you live long enough, there will be cancer in your prostate. And a lot of guys, those guys are dying of something else. So on the one end, we have guys that we are saving from death from prostate cancer. On the other hand, we have a whole bunch of guys who basically who got treated who we probably shouldn't have, which really goes back to your reference about treatment and side effects. So we really don't want to over-treat. We don't want to give you side effects and not change your life expectancy. That we haven't done you any favors.
So I want to follow up on Jim's question and ask you this, because people are always talking about this. If you have prostate cancer,
right?
Are you better off doing the radiation or are you better off doing the surgery?
You got to let me get there. So we want people, we don't want them to die of prostate cancer. But we don't want to over-treat them.
Right.
So if you have a life expectancy that's good, 10, 15, 20 years, you really might consider PSA screening. I do think we've made a difference. I still think there's worthwhile doing a PSA test.
Me too.
So then what? Well, then you might consider, do we want a prostate biopsy? And that has a 1% to 2% infection risk. That has some, it is uncomfortable. We can really help prevent that with lidocaine, novocaine.
Sure.
And then the next filter, and I think this is the really critical one, Jim, that might help answer your PSA screening question, is what if you find prostate cancer? You shouldn't always treat it. And that's the crucial thing. I think if we avoid the urge, for whatever reason, if we avoid the urge to treat everyone just because we find it, we can do a better job of treating folks who we really might help lengthen their life while avoiding over-treating a bunch of people. And I think if you can apply those filters and you can apply some self-control, both from the patients and certainly from the physicians, then I think PSA screening is still worthwhile. U.S. task force has said don't check anybody, which I think tosses out the baby with the bathwater.
Sure, that's wrong.
But we really have to show some restraint. Restraint about who gets screened, restraint about who we treat. And I think if you think it through and talk to people about risks and benefits and really are careful, I think we can have a better job of avoiding over-treatment. And in that realm, PSA screening is helpful.
Jim, any last questions on that?
Self-control sounds like a very good advice, if sometimes hard to follow. Thank you very much.
Yes,
by the way, Jim, I'm with you. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 from Jim to Bill. Bill in Millbrook. Millbrook's right in your neighborhood there.
Yeah, a little east of us.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Jim.
Hi, I'm Bill.
Oh, you're Bill.
Yeah, I'm
Oh,
Bill.
Yeah, Bill. Alan. Jim left us. I appreciate
Jim's
that.
Yeah, Jim's gone.
Millbrook,
well, listen,
yeah.
To make it fast, about a little over a year ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Yes, sir.
I had a biopsy, very low level. Out of 12 cores, there was the smallest amount possible in one of them.
Right.
And we decided on a watch and wait.
What Gleason score?
6.
Ah, so that's the people who should really do a surveillance. In theory, low volume, low grade disease is a patient you don't treat.
So 6 right. in Gleason is low and 10 is high, right?
Correct.
All right, now let me get to the question.
Sure.
The 3 months ago, I was diagnosed with mesothelioma.
Oh, boy.
So I wound up down at Memorial Sloan Kettering. They did 4 treatments of chemotherapy. And I went for my usual 3-month PSA check, and it spiked from what had been 4, the prior 3 or 4 tests, to 12.
Yeah.
And neither the oncologist or the urologist seemed to know if there was any kind of relationship between chemotherapy, which was the only thing that had changed in that time, and PSA. And I'm wondering if you know of anything.
Well, I have to admit, I don't know what the current mesothelioma medications are.
Cisplatin.
Yeah, platinum.
Cisplatin, mm-hmm. And
right.
The other one begins with A.
Adriamycin, maybe.
Alimta. Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
I can't say that I know of any particular side effects from those type of chemotherapy making the PSA rise.
Mm.
You know, certainly anyone, there are other things that can make your PSA rise. So if your prostate gets inflamed at all, if you've had a catheter in your bladder during some of your treatments, if you're in the hospital and they had to put a bladder catheter in, that can create irritation. If you've had a bladder infection, if you've had cystitis, that can make your PSA go up. Mesothelioma is probably really your bigger concern here.
Well, yeah, that's what the oncologist said.
Yeah.
You better deal with that, which I'm doing currently.
Yeah, and a Gleason 6 low-grade cancer is really not your threat.
Yeah,
and
at the end of my last chemo, I did a PSA, and I'd gone down to 6.
Okay.
So the urologist said, well, that's very promising.
So something created some inflammation in the prostate. You know, maybe it was the chemo. We just don't recognize that.
Right.
We know a lot of things. We don't know everything, obviously.
Right.
But it may have been something, an infection you got because of the chemo, because your immune system was suppressed. It could have been a catheter you had in.
Yeah. Yep.
Doc, could you explain something to me? I always confess my ignorance. Mesothelioma is what?
That is a malignancy of the lining of the chest cavity.
I gotcha.
You know, most commonly associated with asbestos exposure.
Right. I know I hear the lawyers talking about it all night long on the radio.
Lawyers will be after you right away.
Right.
Yeah,
tell
sure.
Okay. Hey, Bill, good luck to you.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for this program.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Thanks, doctor, very much.
Yes,
bye.
Sir.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Lenox. Lenox being spelled with one N. Go ahead. Tom
Hi,
in
doctor.
Lenox.
I'd like to ask Dr. Petro, a doctor told me once that alcohol and coffee was about the worst thing for the prostate. Is that pretty true? Or
I don't know necessarily. Yeah, Alan is picking up his coffee cup here. I don't know that it's necessarily bad for your prostate. You know, alcohol, spicy foods, caffeine can certainly aggravate urinary symptoms. It can make you feel like you have to urinate more often and more frequently.
Yeah.
So for guys who have some BPH, some benign enlargement, and they're starting to get some urinary symptoms, you can aggravate those.
I'm really glad you're here.
Yeah, excellent. So some guys have some...
So if you're going to the bathroom a lot, you probably want to lay off the coffee.
You may want to lay off the caffeine.
Yeah.
But certainly people can get prostatitis, which, boy, that's a whole other, you know, that's a whole other can of worms. But that's a... inflammation of the prostate. We don't necessarily understand why people get inflammation of the prostate all the time. But again, those irritants can make prostatitis and the voiding symptoms more prominent.
Wow.
But I don't think necessarily bad for the prostate, but they can bother symptoms.
What do you drink, Doc?
I'm a coffeeholic.
A coffeeholic.
Yeah, I like coffee.
Yeah, you like me. I knew a guy in the profession who just drank hot. He was a gastroenterologist.
Yeah.
All he drank was hot water.
Yeah. I'm
a little.
Yeah, I don't have that much self-control.
Yeah, me neither. Hey, Tom, anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Tom. Let's go to John in Beckett, where everybody dances. John, you're on.
Yes. I'm a 72-year-old man at this point, and in having a PSA test in August of 2010, I had a reading of 6.39, and then in November of the same year, 5.5, at which point I asked the physician if there was anything other than cancer or inflammation which might cause an elevated PSA. And he said, well, sexual activity prior to taking the test.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
Within what time frame? He said, well, within 3 days.
Yeah, right. We tell people 1 or 2 days of abstinence
test. Why is that?
Okay, and this is something I'd never heard before. And so I made sure on my next test that factor did not play into it.
Yeah.
And it went down to 2.66.
Whoa.
Ooh. That's
and
a,
then suddenly, yeah. And then... So that was in March of 2011, and then June of 2011, I had another test, and it was 1.52.
Wow.
That was pretty dramatic, and
right.
And I just wonder why that kind of information doesn't seem to be more broadly disseminated.
No, right.
I don't know if I can answer why it's not more broadly disseminated.
No, but it's a very good
but
question.
A good
I
point,
never heard
right.
it before.
So, no, it's true that we do see there's many things that can make a PSA be falsely elevated. Inflammation, and you may have had some sort of smoldering inflammation that made it be up in the 5 to 6 range even, 6 months apart, a year and a half ago. So it sounds like your real true baseline is 1.5 to 2.
But
it may not have been just the ejaculation that did that.
But following up on his very good question, does the fact that the PSA goes down when you refrain from sex indicate either that you're getting a false reading or does it in fact indicate that there may be some danger by involving yourself in that kind of activity to your prostate?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that sex is bad for your prostate. But the PSA going down is certainly, we do know that, and it doesn't always get widely disseminated.
Well,
yeah, right.
Let me put it this way, John. I'm glad you called because the first time I ever heard it.
Yeah.
I've been doing this show for a long time.
Yeah, right. So don't ejaculate 2 days before your test.
No.
One of the things which led me to wonder is if there are folks – who have been in that situation and then had a biopsy unnecessarily.
I'm sure there have. You know, so one of the first steps when someone comes in with this an isolated elevated PSA is I'll ask them to come back 8 weeks later with another one. And half the people I've avoided even the next step of considering biopsy because it really can drop.
So. Well, John, thanks so much for this very important call. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Joe in
Texville.
Texville? Where are you, Joe?
Catskill.
Catskill. Oh. Almost yeah. Texville.
Almost.
No. Well, I'm 62 years old, and I get injections for low T levels every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I also... am getting an elevated red blood cell count.
Right.
One doc wants me to quit taking the injections.
Yeah.
The other doc doesn't think it's okay, but he wants to wait and see. What would you do in that situation?
So low testosterone, low T is what you're describing.
Yes.
Which, sorry, Alan, we've got another hour. We can talk about low testosterone.
And we will have, I guarantee you, based on your performance today, Paul, we will.
But testosterone, you know, it normally does drift as we age. And I can be a little cynical about the pharmaceutical companies at some time, but there's a real push nowadays to have everyone check their testosterone. Not everyone needs to have it replaced, but there are folks who really have a low value, and it really can be worth it to replace
it. Well, why is it so bad if you have low testosterone?
Well, so if it's really low, it can affect mood, it can affect energy, your vigor, your sense of well-being, it can affect body muscle mass, it can affect adipose, you tend to lose muscle and gain fat when your testosterone really drifts.
Whoa.
So normally our testosterone rises in the morning and drifts over the course of the day. That's a circadian rhythm.
Wait a second, say again?
Rises in the morning.
Yeah.
And drifts over the course of the day,
yeah,
like cortisol and other hormones. So that's right. That's a circadian or a daily rhythm. Uh-huh. Sun goes up, sun goes
down.
Does
it have to do with your daily sex drive?
It probably has to do with, you know, getting you up to go, driving you, you know,
yeah.
Evolutionary, yeah. How do we end up like this? So for some folks, I have to say my intuition is that if I'm going to replace someone's testosterone, I'd rather do it in a daily fashion. So an injection works pretty well, but the problem is you get this big spike, and then it drifts over the next couple of weeks, and then you're down to the basement. And then you get a big spike well above the target normal, and then it drifts back down to the basement. So you can have smaller windows, so a 1 week injection instead of a 3 week, or you could give a daily medicine. So I tend to prefer the gels because they are a daily application that at least mimics the natural circadian rhythm.
Where do you put them?
Well, the gels you rub onto your skin in the upper chest or upper arm. So you might go to a daily application. So some of the big boost you're getting maybe because of the injection. And now one of the side effects of testosterone supplementation is polycythemia, or your blood getting too thick, which is what you're describing. Your red blood cell count is too high. If it gets really too thick, you might even have someone donate blood, basically pull off some of those extra cells to thin the blood back out. And you really should probably go on a holiday until you get your blood count back down to normal.
When you say holiday, you mean?
Drug holiday. Stop taking it for a while.
Stop taking it, yeah.
Yeah.
What if your testosterone is too high?
Then you're
naturally.
I think then you're playing football.
Then you're playing football. It's good for you.
Yeah, right.
Right, yeah.
You're playing for the NFL, I would guess.
Interesting. Because my doc tested me for testosterone.
Yeah.
And it came out.
Yeah, but it does normally drift. And so then the question is, what's normal? You know, if it's normal drift as we age, then who should be getting it? But we have folks come in, it's 100. That's low. And that's really worth treating. A couple of trials came out, New England Journal, I think, recently, that older men who really have poor mobility, they don't get around very well, they're in walkers, they're in chairs. You gave them testosterone, make them feel better, and they had higher rates of heart attacks and strokes.
Whoa.
So testosterone can really be worth it, and you can get some real benefits.
Why is that? Why do they get the strokes?
Because it made them probably hypercoagulate, probably led to some thicker blood.
Oh, I see.
So testosterone is great. If you're really low, it can help you feel better and improve your baseline health, help prevent metabolic syndrome. But you do have to be careful. There are some side effects. And it's helpful to be a vigorous, active guy if you're going to get that replaced.
Wow. Joe, are you satisfied?
I am. But so high red blood cell count is dangerous in and of itself. Yes.
Yes. Right. It makes your heart makes your heart beat harder. It's pushing around more thicker sludge-like blood rather than the thinner, more viscous stuff. You know, the guy who holds the world record for climbing the Alpe d'Huez, Marco Pantani, died of congestive heart failure at like age 36 because his heart gave out because he was, you know, he was blood doping. Right, he was doing testosterone. He was thickening his blood up. So if your heart—you
mean on purpose?
Well, yeah, it's how they win the Tour de France, but not Lance, of course. But that's
the other guys.
But there is a real consequence of having your blood too thick. Your heart has to work harder. It's pushing around sludge. It's just thicker.
Hey, we're out of time, Joe. Okay. You gave us a great topic to talk about. We appreciate it very much. And have fun down in Texville, will you please?
Thanks a lot.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
That was a joke for those of you who didn't get it. We're also out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in. You are great and really great questions today. Thanks for joining us. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice Physicians, offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by, Paul Wildfire. That's who they were answered by. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Chartok. On tomorrow's program, it's an open forum on something, at which point it'll be closed. Stay tuned now for a news update.